It's great to be here. I'm encouraged down there in London and coming back this morning to the earlier session by the reports of life and growth in the churches here in Scotland. I think especially noteworthy for this meeting of the college today, I'm encouraged by one thing in which the Baptist churches in Scotland are higher up the league table than most other denominations in the country. And that is, you have a higher ratio of ministers to churches than most of the denominations. If you read the UK Christian Handbook, and I hope you all have it, you ministers, because we publish it, the 1983 edition shows, if you look at it carefully, that practically all the churches that are growing have a 0.9 ratio of ministers to churches or higher. There are a few exceptions, but these can be explained by other factors. And I believe that that single fact is an indication that God has growth in mind for the Baptist churches in Scotland. Because in advance, He is calling and equipping and sending you ministers for the work that He is going to do. So nothing is more important than what happens to these ministers, especially the newer ones and the younger ones. They must not go through the sapping of confidence of the last few generations of ministers, among whom are my own. So I want to talk to you this morning about the confidence of ministers. I do this with some hesitation. I recall my own feelings when I was in the thick of pastoring a local church and had to come and listen to generalists or specialists who were years removed from how it is in the local church. And I didn't take kindly to them telling me how I should do my job, especially if they had little recent experience in the field. Well, now the roles are reversed. I'm 12 years removed from pastoring a local church. I only know it as a member and as an elder. So to you men who are in the ministry, do please edit what I say with your own closer understanding of the task. But as I begin to talk about the confidence of ministers, let me begin with and set the scene with the story of the Texan who built a 10-acre swimming pool. And he got all the sharks and lampreys and other carnivorous man-eating fish that he could get, and he peopled his pool with these fish. And then he held a great party to inaugurate the opening of his swimming pool. And when all the guests were there assembled, he spoke up to them all and he said, "Now, I have a special reward for the first man that will get into that pool and swim to the other side." He said, "He can either have $200,000 in this house here, or I'll give him 1,000 head of cattle and the ranch to go with it, or he can have the hand of my daughter in marriage and he'll get the lot one day." So he had no sooner finished speaking than there was a splash and there was a man in the pool. And he was striking out for the other side, and he swam and he swam, and there was a lot of turbulence around him as he went. And eventually he got to the other side with everybody applauding. He pulled himself out, and there he stood with his clothes torn off him and dripping in blood and his flesh lacerated. And the little Texan rushed up to him and said, "Which reward do you want? Do you want the money in the house? Do you want the cattle in the ranch? Or do you want the hand of my daughter in marriage?" He said, "I only want to know the name of the man that pushed me in." Ministers sometimes feel like that. How did I get into this? In a study of 149 ministers recently, 84% said they had experienced low morale, which had affected their work as ministers. In choosing the pastoral ministry as a career, we choose to man an outpost of unequaled danger, which threatens us not only from without, but from within. It is in the nature of our work. One minister describes this inbuilt danger in a memory of his ordination. The officiating minister preached on two texts from Matthew. One was the command to the disciples to go out into the world and preach the gospel. The other was that it would be better to have a millstone fastened round their neck and be drowned in the depths of the sea than to cause anyone who believed in him to sin. And he wrote, "As I knelt there, with the hands of the assembled ministers and elders heavy on my skull, I had no doubts, if ever I had any before, that it was a risky as well as a holy trade that I had chosen." And the great danger is that we lose our confidence. I have not noticed this talked about or written about much in UK. There is more written about it in the United States, but I don't believe that the situation is very different here. We just expect every minister to cope with it on his own. I don't think this is good, so I shall try and broach the subject. And I would take as my text, if I need one, verse 4 of the chapter that was read, where Paul says, "We say this because we have confidence in God through Christ." There is nothing in us that allows us to claim that we are capable of doing this work. The capacity we have comes from God, and it is He who made us capable of serving the new covenant, which consists not of a written law, but of the Spirit. The written law brings death, but the Spirit gives life. Let me stand back first then and look at a context that saps confidence. Broadly speaking, there are two parts to our particular context: the world and the churches. On the world, I just want to focus on three aspects of things that make it difficult to be confident in the ministry today. The first we call pluralism. We now live in a multi-faith society, in a highly mobile population. And the instant media let us know what everyone believes all at the same time. Do you still tell Willie Barclay stories up here? I like the one that he tells about the journey he was having back from Fort William to Glasgow in the old days when the trains had leather straps that let up and down the windows. And there were two rather rough-looking men, young men, and one of them took out a razor, an open razor, and began stropping it on the leather in the carriage. And he was rather nervous about what might happen before he got to Glasgow. And it went all right. And just before they got out, this young thug turned and asked him if he would give him his blessing. From the conversation, he had deduced that perhaps he kicked with the other foot. And he said, "But I don't think I belong to your church." "Oh," said the boy, "it's all right. My mother taught me to ask a blessing of any of you. You might all be right." And in this situation, we're asked to show ourselves tolerant of all, and yet expected to have clear, strong convictions at the same time, and it saps confidence to keep doing it. Then single-issue politics don't help. Pressure groups raise a standard in a highly public way about peace, about disarmament, about abortion, about euthanasia, and they come to us direct, or they come to us through our people to find out where we stand. We know we can't take on all the causes. And often we feel we cannot speak out on one without betraying another truth. And it saps confidence. And then secularization has affected our role and status in society. Someone did an interesting bit of research on the images of Protestant clergy in American novels recently. And he came to the conclusion that in fiction today, American novels, in fiction today, No cleric is taken seriously as a public opinion maker or as an intellectual or cultural leader. That's a long way from the time when the parson was the person in the community. Now we often feel we're a nobody, a doormat. And that saps our confidence. But turning to our context in the church, again I want to select just a few features. The first has been mentioned already today, decline. Most of us have had to live with our congregations getting smaller. That saps confidence. And then there's the pedestal effect. In spite of this, maybe because of this, our church people try to make a pedestal for their minister and put him on there and keep him there. It comes out very clearly in this quotation, which is intended to be a bit of serious writing, and I'm only changing the word priest to the word minister in the quotation. A minister, it says, is a miracle of God's love to us. A man who through his ordination becomes another Christ to us with powers that beggar human imagination. Nothing can be greater in this world of ours than a minister. Nothing but God himself. A minister understands all things. A minister forgives all things. A minister is a man who lives to serve. A minister is a man who has crucified himself so that he too may be lifted up and draw all things to Christ. A minister is a symbol of the Word made flesh. A minister is the hand of God's mercy. A minister is the reflection of God's love. He teaches God to us, brings God to us, represents God to us. Who then is capable of such a task? Our people know intellectually that their ministers are human beings, but there are deep, instinctive, historical, and subliminal roots for this semi-deification of the clergy. In many, there's a deep need for an omnipotent, benevolent father, or for a hero figure, or for a personal high priest, or some kind of substitute saint whom we can pay off to be perfect, to pray, to read the Word, to witness, to minister to those in need, and to do any other Christian duty we don't enjoy, all at the bargain rate of a few pounds an hour. It saps confidence. And then there are conflicting expectations between us and our people. It's not just the pedestal, it's the impossible pedestal of conflicting expectations. The tension is between being a priest and a prophet. A priest's job is to preserve culture and tradition. The prophet's role is to change it. There's also the tension between the pastoral and the prophetic roles. Comforting the disturbed. Disturbing the comfortable. The pastor is expected to be both a leader and a servant. A professional and a generalist. Ministers must teach, but they have to recruit their own classes. They're sometimes lawyers, sometimes social workers, sometimes editors, sometimes entertainers, salesmen, decorative pieces for public functions, and are supposed to be scholars into the bargain. They visit the sick, marry people, bury the dead, admonish the unethical, and try to stay sane themselves when criticized. They plan programs and appoint committees when they can get enough volunteers. People expect their minister to be serious, but not solemn. Unworldly, but possessed of some practical sense. Wise, but not smart. Gentle, but not effeminate. Poor, but not paupers. Unctuous, but not pompous. Neat, but not natty. Diligent, but not ambitious. Upright in conduct, but not censorious of theirs. Forthright, but tactful. Affable, but reserved. In short, the human being who's a minister does a poor job of sometimes trying to be like God, combining elements of justice and mercy in his person, and there's no escape. but it saps confidence. Fourthly, in the church, we're beginning to experience the success syndrome affecting us. Productivity is a concept with growing use as a measure in our world. In a culture measuring a person's value by their productivity, what does a minister produce? Khrushchev called priests black-robed devils who ought to be put to work. We know that communist approach. But it can be here with us in subtler form. Perhaps its most recent guise comes in a field with which I'm particularly closely identified. Church growth, with its very pragmatic approach to church life. Someone said rather cynically, all other factors being equal, whenever you see a church that is rapidly growing, you can bet on one thing, someone is hustling. In the final analysis, church growth comes through hard work. But it's not as simple as that. Some ministers who are prepared to pay the price for growth do not see growth as others do. God makes the plant grow. And just as we cannot attribute genuine growth to anyone but God, so we cannot have it both ways and attribute the absence of growth necessarily to the minister. One experienced pastor in the States said recently that this single factor alone has been more responsible for clergy breakdowns than any other in the last 10 years. Church growth is a powerful tool to help a church identify the nature of its problems and set its priorities. But if it devalues the minister, it is being used in a way that denies the faith we profess. And it can sap our confidence. So we have a context both in the church and in the world that saps confidence. Let me go on to speak about the symptoms of shaking confidence. Confidence is not the first word we think of when we're in trouble as ministers. Because of the nature of our work in preaching and counseling, it might even be the last. Because we have to keep a front, a confident front. Let me then set out some symptoms that show before one realizes that the trouble is shaking confidence. We'll look at three areas. First, in the family. Nothing has shaped the character of the Protestant ministry as decisively as the fact that we are permitted, indeed encouraged, to marry. Inevitably, our families are bound up with our ministry. And where would we be without the patience and support of our wives and our children? But when we're in trouble, an area that shows it early is the home. At the best of times, we know that our wives feel they're competing with the church for their husband's attention. And our children could complain of having a pastor, but not a father. If you want something good on that, read Alexander White's piece on Eli and his characters. Devastating. But when our confidence is being undermined, it shows in irritability at home. In unusual outbursts of anger, in going around not noticing things that we would normally notice, in a feeling of being glad to get out of the house and not much relishing going home, in reduced sexual activity, in marital discord. I'll not labor it. But these are symptoms that show that our confidence is waning. And in the church, let me just touch on a few things. When we are getting too tied up with people that we are counseling, it is dangerous. Their dependence on us, their gratitude to us, their need of us becomes fuel for the dying embers of our own self-confidence. If you want that spelled out, read Derek Byrne and Games People Play on the game called Psychiatry. And we may see it in a growing penchant for counseling the opposite sex. Again, never stopping. Always something else to do. An eternal nagging backlog of activities to catch up with. Never enough time. Running to stand still. Because ministers have few other status symbols today, our crowded diaries become status symbols for us. Our diary is crowded with the needs of others. But we've become a responder rather than an initiator. And yet we technically have more control over our time, our discretionary time, than any other profession. Always at it can be a symptom of trying to bolster up waning confidence. Cynicism. Sometimes I think this is the greatest temptation of the Christian ministry. The temptation to be cynical. It can be just internally writing off people's motives as ulterior and feeling comfortable when we've done it. But my memory of fraternals also reminds me that those of us who have a gift with words, and many of us have, can express our cynicism with devastating effect. And when this intrudes beyond the fraternal into our preaching or our conversation with people, we're in trouble because we're trying to raise our own flagging confidence by pushing somebody else down. Internally, the symptoms of shaking confidence are like the legion of demons that harass the man of Gadara. If I seem to know a lot about this, it's because I do. No joy. Emotional exhaustion. An underlying sadness and unhappiness running through life to all that we do. A symptom of shaking confidence. Self-doubt. Doubt about the wisdom of past decisions. Was I right? Or could I have been wrong? Endlessly replayed by the tape in our head. Indecision in the present, always putting things off till later. And for the future, will I be able to carry on? How long will I be able to carry on? A symptom of shaking confidence. And one of the worst, loneliness. A feeling of isolation. No one you feel you can talk to. No one who understands. Being friendly to everyone and feeling you have no friends yourself. A symptom of shaking confidence. Jealousy of others. Others who get the crowds. Others who get the big churches, the denominational office. Others who get to travel. Others who can speak so slickly or who are so popular. Others who seem to have more money. While you're unrecognized for your work, your hard, slogging work. Jealousy is very understandable, but not very helpful. And it's a symptom of shaking confidence. A feeling of being locked in, preaching freedom in Christ, and knowing and feeling you're a prisoner. Feeling that you've got nowhere to go. Too late to change jobs. Would let the side down if you left the ministry. Stuck. A symptom of shaking confidence. Another way it comes is working everything into a routine, predictable way to edit out the agony. Insistence on formality, rules, principles, even dignity, to the point of being obsessive about it. You transfer your confidence to a system of theology, system of liturgy, system of practice, system of management, and you trust in that absolutely. And it can be a symptom that your own self-confidence is shaking. Desperation for a move to another church.
This is one of the ways our shaking confidence is concealed. We move on to do for another few years what we were unsure about in the last few years. Someone has cynically said, if a minister keeps moving, the only thing he needs to change is his address. It can be a symptom of shaking confidence. Now, all this is pretty devastating to say it all in one talk, isn't it? But we shouldn't be surprised that there are so many things to undermine our confidence. For we are at the sharp end of the conflict between the church as it should be and the increasingly secular world we live in. You get this note in the New Testament, in Paul, in several places. In Colossians, as I was reading it the other morning, he says, by means of my sufferings, I'm helping to complete what still remains of Christ's sufferings on behalf of his body, the church. In Galatians, he uses the picture about having the pains of childbirth as part of what it was taking for Christ to be formed in others. It's in the nature of things that we should have the first waves of lack of confidence that in fact are surging and going to surge around our people. For if we are going to be able to comfort them, we need even more than they to have experienced the sorrow and the agony so that we know the comfort of God and can share it. The only remarkable thing about this is that we should be surprised by it. This is the ministry. These are not unfortunate extras to the ministry. And we're all in the same boat. If you feel that lack of confidence, then be sure you're not alone. Let me turn now to actions to maintain confidence. I began with Scripture. We have confidence in God through Christ. There's nothing in us that allows us to claim that we are capable of doing this work. That capacity comes from God. It's He who has made us capable of serving the new covenant, which consists not of a written law, but of the Spirit. For the written law brings death, but the Spirit gives life. I would like to begin by emphasizing the not of this passage. Not of a written law. The confidence we seek to maintain is ultimately not maintainable by any system because its roots are outside and beyond that which any system can deal with. It's not maintainable by any rule or any discipline or any scheme or any method, or any understandings, or any wisdom, or any truths, or any principles, or anything purely cognitive or rational. And God knows in Scotland we have tried to reduce our Christianity to things that are ultimately cognitive and rational. There is a place for these things. But the kind of problem that I'm talking about today cannot be ultimately solved by any of these things that have purely and solely a cognitive and rational base. Because they are dealing with something that is deeper than that, and they have roots that are deeper than that. It is not by any letter, for the letter kills, and it's the Spirit that gives life. We have confidence in God through Christ. Nowhere else, no one else. If we have a crisis of confidence, it's to bring us directly to Him. Every other solution will prove a broken system that holds no water. And I cannot emphasize this too much. At this kind of crunch, we find that Jesus is the only Savior and only Jesus is our confidence. It's taken me a long time to discover and say that in reality, but I have. I am a systems person from tip to toe. I am a child of the 20th century, rationally, empirically viewed world. But I've proved it empty and need to go through it and beyond it to Christ alone. And all that I shall say now are but hints as to how we might come to him to have our confidence renewed, not ends in themselves. First, learn to stop. In the life of Jesus, there is a rhythm of involvement and withdrawal that is important for us to cultivate. He didn't go back always when people shouted for him. He got away and he took his disciples with him. We need to learn to break, to stop. We need to do that physically. We need literally to stop and do something else. For me, it is to walk and more recently to run. I'm round by Westminster Bridge every morning at 6:30. But I need to do it and keep doing it every day. For others, it may be sport or gardening or something less notorious. But if my body is the temple of the Spirit, I ought to make sure it's in as good a shape as I can make it, and I've got to stop and make time to do that. That means exercise if I have a sedentary occupation or I'm always climbing in and out of a car. And it means healthy eating habits. It means stopping eating. But let others know what you're doing and why, or they'll begin to wonder what's going wrong with this guy. I remember how it happened in Nairobi. I was climbing the walls at that time. I've climbed the walls a few times. But I went to the deacons, who were all businessmen, and said, "Would you write me a job description?" "You want one?" "Sure." So they went away and they tried to write me a job description. They came back and the treasurer said to me, "Tom, we find it difficult to write you a job description. How about you writing a job description and showing it to us? We'll tell you whether we agree with it or not." So I wrote my job description. I suppose this was back in 67. So I brought it to them, and actually I put in it that I would have one complete day off with no church activity and no other church activity. And they took it and went away and they came back and said, "Tom, that's an awful lot." I said, "Well, that's about half of what I'm doing. Do you agree that's what you want me to do?" I said, "Yes." I said, "All right, let's try it for a year and then we'll come back and talk about it again." And that was when I started getting one day off a week, when I deliberately did not do anything Christian. You know what I mean. But you see, I told them. They knew it. They knew there was a problem. And they were ready to help me. I've had to relearn that several times. It doesn't happen once and you're there. But you have to be able to stop mentally as well as physically. Paul speaks about the need for us to renew our mind. I like the story about Oswald Chambers, about the man who went in to be counseled with problems, and he came out of Oswald Chambers' study with a pile of books, hands down here and his chin on the top of them. Oswald Chambers had told him that he had a mind and he was neglecting it. If he went and read all these books and came back and saw him, he would be all right, and he was. A healthy mind and a healthy body. But some of us need to read different things. The trouble with us is that our reading is too close to our job. And if you're going to read close to your job, read the things that will help you to do your job. Don't read the things that will help you to answer questions that nobody's asking. As far as I could see, the books that went round the fraternal were very many of that variety. Read a book about stress. Read a book about communication, about counseling. Read the seasons of a man's life by Levinson if you're in your 40s or early 50s and having problems, and see how other men are facing the same kind of difficulties. And read things that are totally relaxing, so that problems are no longer popping back into your mind every time you turn the page. But you need to stop spiritually also. Research surveys generally show ministers to be very undisciplined in the area of private devotions. I hope you folk who are not ministers here will not listen for this next bit. But although we have beat-ups regularly for our people on the importance of prayer and the reading of the word in the pulpit, the surveys show that the ministers are not all that great in doing it themselves. The phone rings. You have a late night the night before for a good reason. You've got gadgets to fix that have gone wrong. There are children to transport. There's 1,000 reasons. But we do need to find that quality time with God. And I have to tell you, I'm sorry, at 55 years of age, I haven't found a better answer than getting up before anybody else. All this stopping is to get back to the eternal return, to get beyond chronos time, and beyond Kairos time, to Ion time, to the ageless time. So we've got to learn to stop if we want to maintain our confidence. Secondly, we need to seek perspective. When our confidence is low, we're too close to things. We have blinkers. We need to widen our thinking to see the whole canvas. And I want just to give you 2 hints here. First of all, again, at the age I'm at, I know nothing better than the Bible for doing what I need. I'm grateful that when I was 17, a man who was in the ministry and who went out of it because he was a failure said in my hearing, "Do you know if you read 4 pages of the Bible a day, you can read it all in a year?" I said, "You must be joking," to myself. And I pulled my Bible out of my hip pocket where I kept it next to my heart. And I added the pages of the Old to the pages of the New Testament, did a mental arithmetic sum, divided it by 365, and said, "Gosh, he's right." I had read the whole Bible as a teenager within 6 months, and I've read it every year since, sometimes more than once. For myself, not for preparation. I happen to be reading it through in French at the moment. And God speaks to me through reading the whole of his word, for there's nothing like getting the whole, nothing to help you to the whole canvas like all scripture. And shall I tell you something? Do you know the book in my shelves most used next to the Bible? It's Alexander White's Bible Characters. I nearly know it by heart. Because I find there such a range of models, good and bad, that when I'm in difficulty, I can tick through them in my mind and I go and pick them out and read them again. And it spreads the vision and lets me see the whole canvas. Gives me perspective. But the second thing, and this is more recent, not all that recent, I would urge you men, keep a journal. I don't mean a diary, I mean a journal. I've always done this in a kind of a way, but I got serious about it when I started to preach less. The Word of God burns in my heart most of the time, and I wasn't getting an outlet. And so I said, well, I'm going to write these things down, and maybe later I'll read over them again and can be prompted by it. So I started a number of years ago keeping a journal, and since then it's become more serious. The psalmist said, "I said unto my soul," if you are lacking in confidence, if you have a problem, you need to be able to talk to yourself. And talk to yourself in a consistent, continuing way. And to your Lord in a continuous way, so that you remember what you said to him the last time and what he seemed to be saying to you. And the best way to do that is to keep a journal. And if you want a book to help you get started, try The Inward Journey by Morton Kelsey. But this gives you distance and perspective when you're battling it out and feel you don't have anybody else you can talk to. The third thing is cultivate honesty. Or, in New Testament terms, walk in the light. We need to be committed to ongoing self-discovery if we would grow as people. We need to bring the things that are below the surface in our unconscious into the conscious mind so that they can be dealt with. And we need to do that not only with ourselves. We need to be able to share some of that kindly with others. Everything God says to you is not for everybody. Hopes you've all learned that by now. One of the worst things for congregations is a minister that feels he has to tell them everything God said to him. Because half of or more of what God says to you is for you, not for them yet. And the man who bobs up and down in his seat in the study during the week and goes in and hops up and down in the pulpit about things that have excited him that are nowhere near where his people is a menace. And I've been a menace. Not everything God says to you is for everybody or for others. But there are things that you need to share. Make sure that people know you for what you are. It's the only way to get off the pedestal, and what a relief it is to them as well as to you. And we ought to use each other, other ministers, for that kind of confidence. And maybe the college could provide a service. And the last thing I want to say, you'll not be surprised, is we've got to be wholly committed to the task again. We're in this for everything. Christ's price is all. Never was less. When I run round Westminster Bridge, I sing to myself. I memorize hymns and I sing them as I go, and it's the other half of my quiet time in the morning. One of the hymns that I sing nearly every day, it's in Redemption Songs. There's a lot of good hymns in Redemption Songs. It says, "Once it was the blessing, now it is the Lord." And then it goes on, "Once was painful trying, now it's peaceful trust. Once a half salvation, and that was me. Now the uttermost." Commitment is not just one act of surrender, but doing what you say to him and what he says to you daily. And keeping at it and saying, "I'm in it for everything." Have you discovered yet that feeling tired is a rotten reason for not getting up? Just you try it. Try it for a month. Get up and just stagger around for half an hour and you'll find it goes away. Why am I saying that when I'm talking about commitment? Because that is commitment. The time when I don't feel like doing something is the time I need to do it. As far as getting time is concerned, we have to steal it. I'm working on a theory at the moment that God speaks to us more in the evening, the night, and the morning than during daylight. I haven't proved it, so it's not a doctrine yet. But it does mean we have to capture the time from sloth. For what is the flesh? The flesh is eating too much. The flesh is sleeping too much. The flesh is wanting to see too much. It's wanting to hear too much. It's all of the five senses overactive. We don't need to get into complicated categories of complicated sin. Our senses out of control is the flesh. And if we are committed to him, it requires that discipline that gives our whole self to him, every member of our body and every faculty of our feeling, so that we're wholly his. And I believe that as he does that, he renews in us the vision of himself and gives us the confidence that we need. And for that I'm glad, and I pray you will be too. For his name's sake. Amen.